For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Anyway, it's good to be here. I'm glad you guys came out. My name's Eric Chabot. I'll just give a little background about myself. I am from Columbus. I actually grew up in Bexley. Who here's from Bexley? Anybody? All right. What year did you graduate? 1987.
I wasn't born.
Okay. You weren't born yet.
Sorry. That was very
That's what I like at Ohio State. I run into students, they'll be like, I went to Bexley. I'm like, what year did you graduate? So I am originally from Bexley. And for the record, I'm not Jewish, okay? I just want everybody to know that I am not Jewish. Every time I do this presentation or I teach in churches on this, people come up to me like, oh, tell me about your Jewish background. I'm actually not Jewish. I was raised in a mainline denomination on Broad Street in a big church that sits there between two synagogues. I'm not going to mention the name of it. But God had a sense of humor because around 1994, I started asking questions about what I believed. I believed in God. I never was an agnostic or atheist, but I happened to wander into a congregation in this city called Beth Messiah. Has anyone heard of Beth Messiah? There you go. Okay, it's out on Morse Road now. Well, sure enough, the pastor was preaching on the book of Matthew, and I looked at him and I said, boy, he looks really Jewish to me. And I honestly did not know anything about Jewish people who believed in Jesus. I never heard of such a thing. I'd never read the Bible, really. But growing up in Bexley, I knew a lot of Jewish people. I grew up in a Jewish community. I had gone out and hung out with a lot of Jewish people on Friday nights. I could tell you all kinds of stories what we were doing. So most of my friends are really Jewish. I'd say probably 75 to 80% of all my friends were Jewish growing up. I went to a lot of bar mitzvahs. Just knew a lot of Jewish people. So here I was in 1994 going into a congregation that had Jewish people who believed in Jesus. And so here I am, this Gentile kid, not sure about what I believe. Well, about 3 weeks later, I came to faith. That's where I heard the gospel. That's actually how I came to know the Lord, just listening to preaching on the book of Matthew. And then God immediately called me out into Jewish ministry. It was pretty obvious because I had a lot of Jewish friends. I always had a big love for the Jewish people. I was immersed in their culture. So that was 1994, and then about 2004, I started doing ministry at Ohio State. I decided I wanted to engage the campus because I loved evangelism. I wanted to go down and talk to people, Jewish people, anyone I could find. And I certainly have talked to a lot of Jewish people, a lot of non-Jewish people there. So I've been down there since 2004. Then about 2009, I decided I was tired of seeing Christians lose their faith. I got sick of all the skepticism and atheism on the campus, and I decided that we would go ahead and plant Ratio Christi there, which is a nationwide apologetics ministry. We were about the fourth chapter there, and we founded it 2009. We've had William Lane Craig there. We've had Frank Turek there. We've had debates with Bart Ehrman and Michael Brown. We've done debates with the atheist group there. And we're not a church, so when I find people there that aren't in church, I tell them to go to Xenos. So if they're down the campus and I'm talking to them and they're really not in a church, I say, just go to 4th Street. It's over there. That's your church. I said, we're a parachurch ministry here. So anyway, I do have a connection with Xenos in that way. I graduated. I have a seminary degree from Southern Evangelical Seminary. That's a pretty well-known apologetic school down in Charlotte. And I do teach regularly at Beth Messiah. It's called the Messianic Studies Institute. Some of you in here may be taking some classes there. We offer Hebrew and Greek, and we have some scholars come in every year and teach on some really cool subjects. I teach Messianic prophecy there, Messianic apologetics. I teach the resurrection. I teach some other classes. So you can go to the website, Messianic Studies Institute. But I actually do work for a mission called CGF Ministries. It's a Jewish mission, and I have been a missionary, work to Jewish people as far as full-time since 2005. So I've had a lot of experience with Jewish people, and that's what I'm hopefully I'm here today to give you some insights into that. Now, I just want to say, I'm not going to make this class or these teachings the next 2 days strictly into Messianic apologetics. I'm not just going to teach on all the objections Jewish people have to Jesus. We're going to talk about that somewhat. I'm going to mention some of their objections, but I also want to give you a little background on some other things. So if you're disappointed, like, I just want to go over all their objections, and this is Xenos because we love apologetics here, and I love apologetics too, just remember that we're not going to have time to go over all the Jewish objections. Now, I left you a bibliography here, and here there's a PowerPoint. There's a bibliography up here on the front chair if you guys didn't get it. And you had some of these books down in your bookstore. From what I understand, a lot of these have already been sold out. I guess they already started selling before I even got here today. The Michael Brown books, Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus, there's 5 volumes he has. I sell these in churches, when I speak in churches, and Christians just come up to me, they're like, 5 volumes? Like, how in God's name? How come Jewish people have so many objections? Well, it's a long, messy history, and Michael is the premier messianic apologist next to me, and I've had him to Ohio State twice. I'm good friends with Michael, and he has written 5 volumes, so I think they have maybe 1 or 2 volumes down there in your bookstore. There's also a couple other books they have down there. I already have these at home, but Michael wrote a book called The Real Kosher Jesus. It was a response to Rabbi Shmuley's book on Jesus, how Jesus isn't kosher. So you can get that one down there. And then this one, The Jewish Gospels, The Story of the Jewish Christ by Daniel Borian. He's a Talmudic scholar, doesn't believe in Jesus, doesn't believe Jesus is a Messiah, but basically the thesis of his book is that the deity of Jesus is not something that was like invented by the church way later, which all Jewish people think. It's a pagan concept. He basically says that the whole Son of Man teaching in the New Testament is based in a Jewish theological background. So he really stirred the Jewish community. He wrote this. They weren't really happy about it. But I personally think he's like a closet believer. I can't say for sure, but it's an interesting book. You can get that down there as well. I just want to recommend 2 other books I have on your bibliography real quick. One is by Michael, another book by Michael Brown, What Do Jewish People Think About Jesus? This is like a very good general introduction. I like that book. If you want to get into Messianic prophecy, go to James Rochford's teaching. I just came out of one of his things. But this is really the book that I like. I just use this to teach a class this year. It's by Daryl Bach, Bateman, and Johnston, Jesus the Messiah, Tracing the Promises, Expectations, and Coming of Israel's King. Yes, it's a long, thick book, but there's a lot in here, so I like this one a lot. Michael Brown's books are good as well. Okay, well, having said that, well, first of all, I want to say that when it comes to Israel, you know, as far as being the chosen nation and the chosen people, I don't think the world's ever forgiven them for that overall. I think if we look deeply into history, I think that that's always been a sore point. But when it comes to election, you know, God calling out Abraham in Genesis 12, what we need to always understand about Israel's calling is that the goal is for Israel to be a blessing to the nations, okay? The goal of Israel, when God called out Abraham and talked about this covenant he was making with him, it's always to be a light to the whole world. Israel, when God called out Abraham, the goal was not just so he can form a relationship with Abraham and just like hoard it to himself. It's always about God wanting to reach the whole world. And, you know, it starts way back in Genesis. Actually, the Great Commission doesn't even really start in Matthew 28. It starts way back in the book of Genesis, okay? That's why it's always important to try it, in my opinion, to read the Bible left to right, not right to left. So if you go through the Old Testament, you find out a lot about Israel. And when God calls out Israel and he forms a relationship with Abraham, and then he gives Moses the Torah on the top of Mount Sinai, we find very quickly that God calls Israel to really be distinctive from all the nations. They're supposed to live in an ethical way, a holy way. They're called to be a mediator between God and the world. So the whole goal is, the goal of Israel really is these other nations that would see Israel would want what they have, and that is the one true God, right? So they look at the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and say, you know what, you are his people, I see how you live, I see your holiness, I see your ethics, and you must have the one true God. When God delivered Moses, or he took Moses and used him to, by the way, did you see the movie with Moses coming out? Anyway, so I saw the ad for yesterday, but when he brought Moses out, used Moses as a mediator to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, he did those signs. You notice how all throughout the Old Testament, God says over and over, don't forget what I did for you in Egypt. Don't forget Egypt, right? So the signs are used to show people. People can hear about it, right? This is what God did for Israel with these signs bringing them out of Egypt. And then if you, this is really important because it kind of lays the background of everything about Jesus. Now, that's just what Jesus looked like for sure, by the way. That's the best one I've ever seen. I think in this picture his hair is a little red on both sides, maybe a little brown and red, but anyway. So, you know, let's face it, Jesus is the most controversial figure in the history of mankind. He's also the most influential person in the history of mankind. But the reason I bring this and tie it with Israel is because you really can't understand who Jesus is if you divorce Israel out of the picture, okay? His relationship with Israel is paramount to understanding what Jesus was doing when he came into this world. So when we lay the background in Genesis, we were talking about a few of those texts there. It's interesting, you know, when Jesus comes into Israel, if you read like through the book of Matthew, you notice that when he first tells his disciples in Matthew 10 and he sends them out to evangelize, you know, he kind of sounds like a nationalist a little bit. He tells them, you know, don't go to anybody else, only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He doesn't say anything about Gentiles there. Is anyone here Jewish, by the way? I don't want to put you on the spot. Oh, good. We do have some Jewish people in here. Good. Well, for us Gentiles, you know, we weren't really in the calling here at the beginning. You know, Jesus says, tells his disciples, go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And he says in Matthew 15:24, you know, to the woman there, he says, you know, he tells her, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Well, that sounds very exclusive and very nationalistic, but we need to remember that Jesus is the ideal representative of his people. The Messiah is the ideal representative of his people. And so if Israel's called to be a light to the nations and they're called to spread the knowledge of God across this world, when Jesus comes, it makes perfect sense that he would want to try to get Israel on track. That's why some scholars think that Jesus really came to really just bring, it's like a reform move, like, you know, bring reformation within Judaism at that time, okay? He wanted to reform Judaism, to change it. I can't go into the whole thing right now, but the point is, though, he knows that he has to get them on track, and so he sends his disciples out to reach his own people. But then, of course, since Israel's calling is to be a light to the nations, they're not just supposed to hoard that blessing and calling to themselves. By the end of Matthew, you see a change that Jesus says after he's resurrected. He commands his disciples to go to the nations, right? Now go out and take this message to out all people groups everywhere. Because as I said before, Israel's called to be a light to the nations. You read Jeremiah, he's a prophet to the nations. You read how God lifts up Jonah, sends Jonah to different people group, right, to preach to them. So God's always using Israel to be that light. Now, in a certain extent, you know, when I think of Jewish people today, if I was go to visit a synagogue or talk to my Jewish friends, they generally don't say to me, yeah, you know what, we're really, we're missionaries. We're missionaries to the whole world. We want to spread the knowledge of Judaism everywhere. Out of all the years I've talked to Jewish people, I've only had one Jewish person, I know him to this day because I see him, he goes to high state, is literally trying to convert me. Try to convert me, not to Judaism, but to what's called the Noahide laws, because they think the Gentiles need to observe the laws of these laws that they came up with, the Noahide laws. He thinks that I, as a Gentile, need to observe these. I'll talk about this more tomorrow. But overall, most Jewish people aren't necessarily looking themselves as missionaries, as we all know, trying to convert people to Judaism, okay? So it's interesting, you know, when you talk about this Gentile issue, you read Matthew's genealogy, is that, you know, it says very clearly that Matthew's genealogy begins with Abraham, right? And that's very significant because Matthew saw Jesus was obviously not just the Messiah for the Jews, but for the Gentiles, for the whole nations. And so that's very interesting about his genealogy. Okay, now it's interesting, there are a couple rabbis in the history of Judaism who think very clearly when the Messiah comes, that says here, like one of them here, Rabbi, this one rabbi of sage in the just after the Second Temple here, he says here, when King Messiah shall be revealed, all the nations of the world shall be gathered to him. And then you have another rabbi around 1288 to 1344, who says Moses, by the miracles which he wrought, Moses, by the miracles which he drew, but a single nation, the worship of God, but the Messiah will draw all nations to the worship of God. So the reason I bring this up is most Jews do agree that when the Messiah comes, he is supposed to be a light to the nations. He is supposed to draw the nations to God. So we have that agreement with them. We just believe as Christians the fact that Jesus is the only Jew that has helped 1.4 billion non-Jews come to know the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay? Jesus fulfills Abrahamic covenant. Okay? You know, there's really no other Jewish person that has had an impact on the rest of the nations other than Jesus. Yeah, there's been very influential Jewish people throughout history. There still are. But no messianic figure in the history of Judaism has helped hundreds of thousands of non-Jews come to know the one true God. Okay, that's fulfilled prophecy, which James is talking about today. And I don't want to steal his thunder. Okay, because he'll be here tomorrow talking about it too. Okay, James, that's on your handout, James Rochford. Anyway, that's on your schedule. It's for tomorrow. Okay, so when we come to Paul, it should be no surprise that that Paul talks about Romans, 1:16. He says the gospel is the good news to the Jew first, and then to the Greek, and he talks about the power of salvation. I think there's a good case that verse is still in the present tense. It's not just something that was for then, like it was for the Jew first then. It's still for the Jew first now. It doesn't mean Jewish people are better or anything, but Paul knew the priority was that Israel's calling to the world, that he needed to go to his own people. And that's why when you read the book of Acts, you read all throughout the book of Acts, Paul goes to the synagogue first. He goes to the Jew first. If you read Acts 17:1, I think verse 2, it says it was Paul's custom to go to the synagogue. He goes to Thessalonica. That means it was his custom. Paul knew he needed to go to the Jew first. So that is a pattern of mission all throughout the New Testament, the early apostles going to Jew first, and of course they start going to the Gentiles as well. In Romans 9, 1 through 5, Paul talks about how he wishes that he was cut off or accursed from the Messiah so his countrymen would come to know him. I don't know if I'm willing to ask God to cut me off in order that people might come to know him. I'm not really prepared to do that, are you? So what that shows is that Paul really had a heart for his people. He wanted to see his own countrymen come to know the Lord. And he says very clearly in Romans 9, he talks about the covenants, the temple service, the promises, all these things still belong to Israel. They have these things, okay? I'll talk more about that tomorrow, a little bit of where the church stands with Israel, but the point is that's in the present tense. In Romans 11, if you ever read Romans 11, it's a really critical verse. And by the way, if you really, really want a relationship between Israel and us as Gentiles, Romans 9 through 11 are really critical texts. If you can ever just study those, just milk the marrow out of them. It takes forever. But he says in Romans 11 very clearly that we as Gentiles have been grafted in. We're not apart from Israel. We don't replace Israel. We've been grafted in to that that olive, that tree metaphor there. It's a similar thing that he talks about in Ephesians 2. He talks about a political metaphor here. He talks about how Gentiles, we are fellow heirs with Israel, not replacement heirs or heirs alone, but heirs alongside with Israel. Now, this is very interesting because in the first century, as I'll talk about more, it's interesting, the early church was 100% Jewish. Cornelius was the first Gentile that came to faith, right, in Acts 10. So it's 100% Jewish, and now today, it's kind of the opposite, right? You only have a small remnant of Jewish people who believe today, Messianic Jews, all across the world, different, in the United States and across the world. Sometimes they go by different names. Some of them are in churches. Some of them go to Messianic congregations, depends on who they are. But it's interesting today, you have a very small remnant of Jewish people today who believe, and then mostly the church is mostly non-Jewish, mostly Gentile. So it's just an interesting twist of events that's happened. Now, in the fall, this November, I'm teaching the Xenos, a five-week class on Jewish roots of Christianity, and we'll go over all that there. So that's why you all have to come in November, because I can't teach the whole history there. I don't have time today and tomorrow, but it's a very interesting topic. Okay, so just want to give you a little bit of theology, the background there with the theology of mission. I hope that, we all see, of course, the passion and the drive to reach Jewish people. You're called to reach all people groups, but certainly in the New Testament with the mandate with Romans 1:16 and Jesus' ministry, hopefully we have some passion to reach Jewish people for the Lord. Okay? Now, I just want to go over a little bit of an overview of modern practice Jewish beliefs, beliefs and practices. Now, I grew up in Bexley, and I'm going to be honest, most of my Jewish friends are not religious. I mean, they did not, when I mean non-religious, meaning that when it came Friday night, they weren't telling me I need to, you know, observe the Sabbath and stay home with my family and wake up for synagogue the next day. They were going out with me to the bar, okay? So we were not really, I was not around a lot of practicing, overly observant Jewish people. Now, Bexley has, let's see, like four synagogues. You've got a couple Orthodox. You've got a conservative one. Then you've got the Tiferet Israel down on Broad. But overall, most of my Jewish friends just weren't overly observant, maybe one at the most I can think of. So, you know, it's very interesting, and that's kind of the way it is today, too. But when it comes to Jewish people, there are probably about 15 to 16 million Jewish people worldwide. And obviously, they're scattered all over the world. They're not just remaining in Israel today. We know that some of them are going back and living in Israel. Some Jewish people feel called to do that, but a lot of them still haven't done that. So you can just go just about anywhere. I'd say the most common, as far as the concentration of Jewish people in the United States, obviously New York, New Jersey, Los Angeles, Florida, Cleveland has 70,000. How about that? Columbus doesn't have a huge population, maybe about 30, I think 25 to 30. So the point is you can go all across the United States. New York is obviously the biggest one. Has anyone gone down the streets of New York and Brooklyn and walk down there? I mean, there's tons of Orthodox Jews there everywhere. I mean, temples everywhere, right. It's not like walking down downtown Columbus. You know, I mean, you're lucky if you see one Jewish people there in a blue moon. But I mean, you go to New York, it's a whole different story. So when it comes to Jewish people, you have different sects, obviously. You've got, like I said, you've got Orthodox Judaism. That is the lowest percentage or the smallest amount of Jewish people in the United States are Orthodox. You have what's called Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism. Reform Judaism is really kind of like the more liberal branch of Judaism. Definitely very similar to maybe like liberal Christianity, maybe like churches that, yeah, people go to churches that don't really maybe believe any some of the tenets there. They just kind of go for the cultural aspect. Then you've got Conservative, which is kind of like in the middle between the two, like a meeting ground, not too Orthodox or not too Reform. And then you've got a Reconstructionist movement as well. And you also have what's called Humanistic Judaism. You do have a sect of Judaism that doesn't even believe in God at all. I'll talk about that more. So most of Jewish friends that I have have mostly come from Reform backgrounds. You know, I'd say in Bexley you have a mixed breed. I can, you know, nighttime, Friday night, you'll see them walking to synagogue, some of the Orthodox. But it's kind of a mixed bag there. Ohio State, having done ministry to Ohio State, most of the Jewish people I've met there are not Orthodox. Most of them are just fairly Reformed, come from a Reformed background, okay? But there is a Orthodox group there that meets the Chabad House, so you can go there too if you want, but it's a mixed bag. Now, for Jewish identity, this is a very interesting topic. I would say all Jewish people define their Jewish identity maybe differently. Not everybody maybe defines it the same way. For some Jewish people, like I said, they believe in God. Maybe their identity is in a covenant relationship with God. I would say number three is probably the most common thing you'll always run into with Jewish people, that it's more about culture and community. The Jewish people are very tight-knit. The community is very strong. I admire that. It's not a bad thing. I think they help one another out. They're very, they're just a tremendous community. And then some Jewish people define their identity differently. But the one thing they will tell you that they do identify their Jewishness by, without a shadow of a doubt, is non-belief in Jesus. That is one thing they will identify as a badge of honor. I can tell you, having talked to them, that over the years I've been in Ohio State, other places, they'll say, Eric, I don't believe in Jesus. I'm Jewish. Eric, I'm Jewish. I don't believe in Jesus. Eric, I'm Jewish. I don't believe in Jesus. Okay, I got it. But the point is, though, that belief in Jesus is... non-belief in Jesus is such an essential part of their faith, or their belief. It's just hands off for them. So it's interesting, you know, when they get approached about the claims of Jesus, generally it becomes their identification at that moment. You know, it's kind of like, I don't believe in Jesus. That's an identity part of our people group. We don't believe in him. Okay. For Jewish people, it's interesting. I would say most Jewish people overall that I've met over the years are not really overly focused on next life, thinking about salvation, thinking about what happens to me when I die. There's what's called tikkun olam, and that means repair of this world. And a lot of Jewish people, mostly a central tenet of Judaism, is that they're here to repair the world today. They're supposed to make this world a better place, okay? So they do that. If you look at the history of Jewish people, they're very involved in philanthropy, social work, just doing all kinds of things. They do amazing things, really, if you look at the statistics. But they do believe in repairing this world. So it's a very this world only kind of belief. I don't run into a ton of Jewish people that really are thinking, what happens to me when I die? I need to get saved. No, they don't think in those terms, okay? Jewish people are very committed. The heart of Judaism is in the home and family. Obviously, family unit's very important. They do mitzvot, good deeds based on God's commandments. They don't look at necessarily keeping the commandments of God as like a burdensome thing. It's just part of their faith. Education's very important, hard work. So they believe they're called to sanctify this world, okay, to make it a better place. So that's very important, you know, because they view Christianity generally as a next life religion. Overall, most Jewish people think that we believe that you need to get saved, go to heaven when you die, or somewhere else, and that's it. So I always say to Jewish people, as I do anyone else, eternal life starts now. It starts in this life right now, and it's a quality of life that really does impact your life in this world, but it carries on after you die. So we do care about this world as Christians. Sometimes we come across like we don't. Also something about Jewish people, just about what they believe in general. There's a guy named Maimonides. He was a Jewish thinker in the medieval period, very well known. As far as like what they believe, as far as doctrine or creed, most Jewish people don't really hold to creedal doctrine like Christians do, but they do believe what's called Maimonides' 13 principles, which I can't write them all down. There's a few of them here. I wrote down what Maimonides believed. Maimonides wrote in the midst of Christian persecution. Jews are being persecuted at that time, as they always were. And Maimonides wrote these things a lot of ways in a polemic against Christians about what Christians believed about Jesus. So Maimonides says there's one God. He's created the universe personal, non-corporeal. That means God can't take on human form. He has no physicality. He has no materiality. So right away, you know, that's going to be a problem talking to Jewish people, because if you say Jesus in the incarnation, they're going to look at you like, no, we don't believe that. Very similar to Muslims. They believe in the divine origin of the Torah. They believe, obviously, the Torah is a central moment, defining moment of their faith, and Moses got the Torah on Mount Sinai. They believe it's not changeable in any way. And they have this thing also about the imperative to worship God and not worship any false gods or idolatry. So Maimonides wrote these things in the midst of Christianity and Christian missionary work and Christian persecution as a way to combat what Christians believe. So you can see right away, you're dealing with the Jewish people who believes in these things, as I have in the Orthodox world. One of their big arguments is going to be Jesus can't be God. There's no way a man can be God. It's idolatry. So that's one of their big arguments, which we will go over more as we go forward. Another thing about Judaism, there's 613 commandments found in the Torah, the written law. They also believe in what's called the oral law. And that is what we talk about. It's called the Talmud. They believe that Moses received revelation outside the written law. And that is something that's debatable, of course. But they also read what's called the Talmud, the rabbinical literature. They don't just read the Torah if they read the Old Testament. And they don't necessarily, I can be honest, a lot of my Jewish friends I grew up don't even having really read much of the talk of the Old Testament. Depends who you're talking to. But the point is that they read all the rabbinic literature. They don't just stick with the Old Testament or the Tanakh. I say Tanakh, it's just a way to say it, Jewish way. Obviously, there's dietary laws, you know, it talks about temple issues. So the oral law provides a lot of commentary in the written law as well. So it's, if you ever read the Talmud, you can get it and read it. It's quite interesting in some of those other writings. But they do read at things outside the Old Testament. So if you're talking to a Jewish person about God or about Messiah or anything, you've got to know the rabbinical literature. You've got to know the things outside the Tanakh. I generally run into that a lot. So you've got to familiarize yourself with that literature. That's why Michael, in these books, Michael Brown, he does bring that up a lot. He does mention a lot of the rabbinical literature as well. And that was his goal in these books. So that'll help you if you get those books. Jewish holidays are really important in Jewish people's lives. A lot of people ask me, you know, what do Jewish people believe about atonement since there's no temple anymore? The temple has been destroyed. Do they believe in blood atonement? No, they don't. They think it's gross overall. They think it's like, kind of like, what do you believe this blood atonement thing? What do you mean this shedding of blood? When it comes to the fall period coming up here in October, September, they have the 10-day period called Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the holy day period. And that is when they try to get right with God. They come to God. They confess their sins. They go to temple, and obviously they get right with man. If they have something they've done against another man or someone else, they'll try to get right with them. But that's that season right there, the very holy time where they observe that period. And now, as Christians, all these holidays right here, like Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Festival, Feast of Booths, these are in the Bible. You can read it in Leviticus 23, the feasts, the seven feasts there. And Jesus actually taught the background of John 10, the feast of Festival of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles is a background of, I'm sorry, John 7. John 7, the background is the Feast of Booths or Festival of Booths. That's the background of John 7 that he's teaching there. You also have what's called Simchat Torah, and you have, of course, Hanukkah, and that's the background of John 10 is Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication. If you read John 10, Jesus is teaching there the background. That's the Hanukkah Feast of Dedication. So these are important to them. You've got Purim in the spring. Talks about the Book of Esther. It's a celebration of God delivering them out of that period with the Book of Esther. If you ever read the Book of Esther, what goes on there. And of course, Passover is very important to them. All my Jewish friends celebrated Passover growing up, even if they're not religious. Most Jewish people celebrate these holidays, even if they're not religious. Okay, it's part of their heritage, and so I don't know too many Jewish people that don't. We had Frank Turek at Ohio State 3 years ago. He did I Don't Have Faith to Be an Atheist, and this Jewish atheist came. I invited her. She was a girl. She got up at the Q&A session and asked Frank a bunch of questions. It's on YouTube, by the way. It went viral. I have to brag about that. But she got up and she asked a bunch of questions about God, and then she came out afterwards at the book table, and we're giving away books, and she comes up. And I said, Hannah, I said, what'd you think? She said, I don't know. She said, I really got to go, though. I got to get to my Sabbath meal tonight. So, see, she was an atheist, but she's going to celebrate Shabbat, you know, that Friday night with her family. So it shows you that she didn't even believe in God, but she still keeps the culture of the faith. So it's interesting. I run into that a lot. We'll talk about that more. So Passover is very important. Obviously, we believe Jesus is a Passover lamb. It's fulfilled in Jesus. Shavuot is another holiday, the Feast of Weeks. That commemorates where Moses got the Torah. That's where we as Christians believe the Spirit of God's poured out in the book of Acts. That's the fulfillment of that holiday for us in the book of Acts, Pentecost. And then you have some minor festivals as well. Of course, the Shabbat is important to them. Some Orthodox, not all Jewish people. Most of the Orthodox. Okay, let me talk a little bit about the, by the way, I'm going to try to time this so we have time for Q&A at the end. So that's the route I'm going. Let's talk a little bit about the Messiah. Now, I'd say overall, considering you're dealing with a lot of Jewish people today that don't necessarily believe in God, which I'll talk about more, some Jewish people could care less if there is a Messiah. Depends on who you're talking to. A lot of Jewish people I've talked to never even thought about it. They're just like, what's a Messiah? Like, what's he supposed to do? Who is a Messiah? I don't really care. Because remember what I said about Tikkun Olam, about them wanting to repair the world now? For some Jewish people who are not overly observant, I mean, meaning that they're just culturally Jewish, they don't see the need for a Messiah to fix this world. Okay, they're going to do it. All right? Why do they need a Messiah to help fix the problems in the world? Okay? The world's an ugly, you know, we've got problems in Israel, we've got problems everywhere. Let's just do it. Let's get involved, get our hands dirty, and we don't need a Messianic or a Messiah to come help us there. I'm saying some Jewish people think this. When it comes to Orthodox Jews, yes, they believe in the coming of the Messiah. Maimonides believed in the coming of the Messiah. Some believe in what's called a Messianic age, where the world will just be a better place, for a more peaceful place. But an issue of a personal Messiah, a Messianic figure, a personal Messiah, the overall view in Judaism is, one, he's not divine. There's no deity aspect to him. He's a Davidic king. And that's it. So there's no incarnation. There's no anything about him. Nothing special as far as like he has to be some sort of divine figure. The overall view, one view is that when the Messiah comes, if you read any texts in the Tanakh, or the Old Testament, you'll see when a messianic figure comes that Israel's dwelling securely in the land. The Jewish people are all gathered back to the land. They're dwelling securely there. And that's when this figure comes. So that's what a lot of Jewish people believe the Messiah is supposed to do, is to help the Jewish people dwell securely in the land. Well, that hasn't happened yet, because if you read the Old Testament, some of the texts are split up into two parts. Some of them speak of Jesus' first appearance, and then a lot of them have to do with the second appearance. So that means, as a Christian, if you don't believe Israel has a future with the land, with the people, you're going to have a heck of a time interpreting those second coming prophecies. You're going to have to wrestle with those in a major way. Some Christians, they see no relevance to those prophecies. They're just like, they're gone. So you'd have to wrestle with those. Also, let's look at what this rabbi's objection is right here. It says here, the state of the world must prove that the Messiah has come, not a tract. Don't you think that when the Messiah arrives, it should not be necessary for his identity to be subject to debate? For the world should be so drastically changed for the better that it should be absolutely incontestable. Why should it be necessary to prove him at all? If the Messiah has come, why should anyone have any doubt? So he's basically saying that these are the expectations that this rabbi is looking at. He's seeing these texts in the Old Testament that speak of some sort of era in Israel's history and in the world. It's like a utopian world where the world's a better place, it's more peaceful. And by the way, if you read those texts, I challenge you to go and read some of these texts. Tell me where, in like Isaiah 2, Micah 4, well, I mean some of these other texts, tell me where you really see the word Messiah. It's nowhere. Nowhere there. There's nowhere hardly really in the Old Testament says, when the Messiah comes, using the word Messiah, this is what will happen, okay? There's only really one specific text that speaks of, says anointed one, and it talks about it in a kingly aspect, and that's what James was just talking about, it's Daniel 9. It talks about the anointed one there. But overall, there's really not a lot of texts, if any texts, to say the word Messiah in them, okay? Isaiah 2 speaks of some figure who's going to split the mountains in two, and the world, you know, something's going to happen there. But I mean, it's just a lot of these texts speak more about the outcome of the world, right? It talks about this issue of the nations going up there into Zechariah and worshiping the messianic figure there. It says he'll set his foot on the Mount of Olives. In Zechariah 14, it talks about that. There's passages that speak of him spreading the knowledge of God, like Isaiah 11:9. I believe Jesus has done that. And then there's other passages that talk about this temple. And a lot of Orthodox Jews believe today when the Messiah comes, he's going to help build the temple, because that's what Maimonides believed as well. So they do see a future restoration of a temple, and they see the sacrifice is coming back. How about that? So if you read Ezekiel 40-48, those are tough texts to interpret, but they do believe that that is part of the overall messianic plan in the future. So most Jewish people who are Orthodox believe when the Messiah comes, he's going to do everything at once. He's going to set up the temple, gather Jews back to the land, and the nations are going to go up and worship the messianic figure, but he will help the nations turn really to Torah. They're going to be, you know, back to the zeal for the law, which some of those texts talk about in the Old Testament. So it's a very interesting topic, but you run into different messianic expectations. Now here's the thing about the word Messiah. I think this is very important. Whenever you're talking about whether Jesus is the Messiah with a Jewish person, let alone anybody, remember there's other names for the Messiah to go by, okay? All these names like Son of David, Son of God, Son of Man, Prophet, Elect One, Prince, Branch, Root, Scepter, Star, Chosen One, Coming One. These are names, when a Jewish person would think of the Messiah, these are the categories they would view the messianic figure, okay? So when you're asking whether Jesus is the Messiah, and it's like asking, is he the Son of Man? Is he the Son of God? Is he the Prophet? Is he the scepter from Genesis 49? Is he the chosen one? These all have to come into play when you're debating the messianic issue, right, with a Jewish person. It's very important because that's how the Messiah would be identified by these names, okay? So just like Son of God or Son of God, people think that's about the Trinity. In a Jewish person's mindset, that's about the Davidic king, okay? That's how they identify the Son of God associated with the Davidic king, because David was a son, right, King David? But Jesus, we believe, is the Son of God, the ultimate Davidic king, okay? Now, remember also something, number two, about the Messiah's mission. As I said before, I really believe one of the main reasons that Jesus really is meets the messianic criteria is because he has helped Israel fulfill their calling by helping millions and millions of non-Jews come to the one faith in the one true God. Okay, now I'm not arguing just because Christianity grew and we have lots of people believing something that makes it true. I'm arguing that there's a very specific promise coming out of Abrahamic covenant from Abraham's seed about one who will come and he will help Israel fulfill their calling, not to mention he's rejected by the majority of his people, as Isaiah 53 talks about. And then it turns out that the door opens the Gentile nations to believe. So Jesus is the only one that has really helped that brought that to pass. Something else that's really important, this issue of sin. I do not find overall, as I've studied Judaism over the years and taught to Jewish people, they view sin the same way as Christians do. Now, does that mean Jewish people don't believe in sin? Not necessarily. But when it comes to like original sin coming out of the garden and how we have this sinful condition that we need change, we need a new heart, we need the Spirit of God to come live in us, we need regeneration, they view sin as more about outward actions. You know, you sin against people by your actions. So they don't necessarily view original sin the same way. So that's going to play a large role in how they view the role of the Messiah. Because remember, when Jesus rose from the dead, he had to reverse the curse of the fall. And they just, that's a whole different concept for them because they're viewing sin in a different light. Okay? Now, I do believe this. You can connect with a Jewish person by talking about the new covenant because Ezekiel and Jeremiah speaks of when the Spirit of God be poured out, he'll come to indwell us. And that is right, that Jesus does do that through via the resurrection. He sends the Holy Spirit. But that's a better route to go than talking about the issue of Genesis, I think. Okay? We'll talk about that more tomorrow. Yeah. I think the Christian view is more of a condition, because I think that Christians, I assume most of us sitting here are Christians. I mean, I would believe that you would think that we have this condition that's been away from God and we need a new heart. We need the Spirit of God to come into our lives and change our condition before God. Now, that will obviously change our outward actions after we have the new heart. We have the new condition. But we're starting more with a condition that will change the conduct. I think they're starting more at the conduct at first versus the condition. I think that's that's why the New Covenant. By the way, if you read the New Covenant passages in Jeremiah and Ezekiel, you notice they're not written, there's nowhere mention of Gentiles in them anywhere. It's written to Israel. That's another argument they have against this. They say those are written to, there's nothing about Gentiles there. Which in Ezekiel 36 and Jeremiah 33, if you read the context, it's written that he'll give Israel a new heart. And they'll not only that, he says it'll happen when you're dwelling securely in the land. So we got a context issue there. What we believe as Christians, at least I believe, is that Jesus brought the kingdom of God. It's been inaugurated. The new covenant has been inaugurated. But I still see a future down the line when God will be with Israel, like Paul talks about, all Israel will be saved in Romans 11. He will be dealing with Israel in that area in the future. But the point back to your issue is a condition of conduct. I think that's, and that's, I don't find most Jewish people to look at me like, oh, I'm a sinner. I need Jesus. I mean, you know, it's just not something they think about. You say the word saved with them, salvation, they don't think in those categories overall. At least I don't find most of them do. Maybe you do. I haven't over the years. Now let's talk a little about atheism, since you guys had your apologetics conference last year and I was here and William Lane Craig came and did his lecture, the exact same lecture he did at High State for us. I was like, that's the same lecture. Anyway, but he's great. But the point is, though, atheism is very important to talk about because, as this rabbi says here, this is absolutely true. It's indisputable that a disproportionate amount of secular Jews self-identify as atheists or agnostics. I find more and more Jewish people I'm talking to don't even necessarily believe in God. Okay? They have a Jewish identity. They have a Jewish culture in their life. Culture is very important to them, which I think is great. But when you pin them down, if they really believe in a personal God, many times they're like, not really that important to them. You may say, how can that be? Well, because one reason is that I think personally is a lot of times, growing up, at least my Jewish friends, I don't think they teach you like systematic theology or teach you Jewish apologetics growing up where you really know what you believe, why you believe. But also the education system. I think obviously a lot of Jewish people are very involved in education. They're influenced by university. They've heard all the arguments against God and against the Bible that we've heard as Christians. So there's a lot of reason why they're agnostic. Does anyone know who Lawrence Krauss is? He debated William Lane Craig 3 times. One of them's in Australia. I'm just going to mention a couple big names here, Jewish atheists. He's a physicist and cosmologist, really obnoxious, by the way. And he was here 3 months ago with Richard Dawkins. They sold out that place downtown, whatever. They showed the Unbelievers documentary. My friend went to it. He was just like, this place is packed. It's all these atheists here. So he went out and Richard Dawkins did this tour. But he's a very, very aggressive atheist, but he is Jewish. Wrote a book called A Universe from Nothing, Why There's Something Rather Than Nothing. See, here he's debating William Lane Craig over there. And you can watch it online. It's in Australia. He's really obnoxious in debates. But anyway, he's an example of somebody that has a lot of influence in the atheistic world. You have another guy here, David Silverman. He's the president of American Atheists. He's Jewish, was brought up Jewish, total atheist now, leads the president of American Atheists. Debated my friend Frank Turk. You can watch it online. The reality debate, which explains reality better, atheism or theism. So the point is that there are some very big atheist names in the culture, and they are Jewish. So I just want to bring that up because when you're talking to Jewish people about the Messiah, it's kind of an irrelevant topic if they don't believe in God. So in many cases, you're having to start just establishing there's a God with a lot of Jewish people today, and you may need, once again, we're back to those good old arguments for God's existence. You know, before you even talk about whether there's a Messiah and whether they even care or not whether there's a Messiah. The latest Pew survey showed, it's online, that I think the statistics percentage-wise, the atheism has gone up higher and higher in the Jewish community. Does anyone know who Spinoza is? Spinoza was a really well-known thinker. He really did a number on miracles, those arguments against miracles. He's Jewish. A lot of Jewish people have read his arguments. That's been a big influence. Some of the rabbis have forbidden their people even read Spinoza. So if you go online, type in Spinoza and read his arguments against miracles. There's been arguments to counter him, but they read a lot of Spinoza's work as well. The point is, though, a lot of Jewish people are culturally Jewish, but they don't necessarily believe in God. Okay, and that's a challenge for us because we have to get to that point as well. Okay, I just want to mention also some limitations here. Just like with all dialogues with anybody, no matter what their background is, especially with Jewish people, there's always 3 barriers as I see it. You've got emotional barriers, you've got intellectual barriers, you've got volitional barriers. Anti-Semitism is alive and well today, but the relationship between the church and the Jewish people hasn't always been pretty. There were a lot of forced baptisms in the past. Thousands and thousands of Jews have been killed because they've been forced to convert to Christianity, have been forced to have forced baptisms, and they didn't want to. Obviously, they were killed. I can give you some resources to read on that, but it's a very ugly history. Now, I know a lot of Christians say those people weren't Christians, did that, the popes or whatever. That's a long topic in itself, but the point is, though, that, yeah. That's not on there? Oh, you know what? I like to do that to you. I like to just add a slide. I like to add a slide that's not on your PowerPoint. That makes you have to write this down or like type it in on your phone. You're like, wait, what's that? So anyway, I just wanted to do that. So I apologize, but maybe this is one slide you don't have. But I think you can remember intellectual, emotional, and volitional here. So there's a lot of emotional barriers. A lot of Jewish people won't even consider the claims of Jesus because they associate him with anti-Semitism. And they're just absolutely still convinced that he is the main reason why so many Jewish people have died throughout the centuries. There was a Holocaust before the Holocaust. Okay, if you study the history, there really was a Holocaust before the Holocaust, the Hitler Holocaust. Okay, thousands of Jewish people have been killed, butchered. It's just a very ugly history. Obviously, you've got intellectual barriers. Like I said, the deity, Messiah, the Trinity, those are other barriers they have a hard time identifying with us on. And then the volitional barriers has to do with their will. As I said, Jewish identity is very important to them. And no matter how many objections you may answer, in the end, they still think believing in Jesus is the most un-Jewish thing they can do. And they're probably going to be rejected by their community and their family if they accept Jesus. There's a chance they will. Not all the time, but Orthodox, it can get really ugly with some of the Orthodox families. What background do you come from? Orthodox?
Reform,
yeah. So maybe not.
It's a brick wall.
Okay, brick wall. Right. So the point is, though, that if someone believes in Jesus, most Jewish people, it identifies as you're leaving Judaism, you're embracing a faith that has nothing to do with Judaism, you're leaving your Jewish identity behind. So there's a big barrier there, no matter how many objections you may answer. We'll talk about it. Okay. Let me mention also some of the critics. I look at critics or those people, I look at apologetics as reaching doubters, seekers, and critics. Doubters are people that are Christians that really are just having doubts. So apologetics can strengthen their faith. Seekers are people or people that are generally asking questions. And then you have critics, like Richard Dawkins, you know, those guys. But critics are people who probably are not even open to the possibility of it being true. They're just absolutely closed off. And you're going to run into that with just Jewish people like anybody else. Now, there's groups called Jews for Judaism or Outreach Judaism who try to help train their people. This is the apologetics to the Jewish community to help them come against people like me and other people, or Michael Brown or others, you know. They provide answers for Jewish people to help them. So there's been books that have been written. This is one written by a guy, Why the Jews Rejected Jesus, A Turning Point in History. I have this book, David Kleinhofer. He's an intelligent design advocate, actually, but he still doesn't agree Jesus is the Messiah. But these anti-missionary groups, like Jews for Judaism, they publish these books, like right here, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, The Real Messiah, Jewish Response to Missionaries. I find both of those books to be incredibly weak, polemically and apologetically. There's been responses to them. Michael has responded to most of them here, and there's been other works as well. But the point is that they put these things out in the Jewish community to help Jewish people combat people like us or me that try to talk to them about Jesus. So there, it's out there. A guy named Rabbi Tobias Singer, he's a very, very aggressive anti-missionary. He's put out this series called Let's Get Biblical. Why doesn't Judaism accept the Christian Messiah? See, the point is, what I'm trying to say is that Jewish people are very protective of their people, okay? And they look at them as saying, I don't want you leaving Judaism for Christianity. That's a whole new religion. So they want to do everything they can to train their people to keep them in the fold, okay? Now, most of the Jewish people I deal with, as far as I've witnessed to, are fairly secular and not overly devout or into this stuff. But when I have dealt with some of these Jewish people that are into this stuff, they're very dogmatic and very difficult to deal with, because they read all this stuff and it's just, you know, they've studied it very deeply. Okay, so the point is that when you're dealing with Jewish people, just like anybody else, is that you've got to know your audience. Some Jewish people, like I said, are not religious. Some of them are atheists. Some of them may not have even thought about the Messiah concept. It just depends on who you're dealing with. I do want to say something, though. I want to say that, as I'll say tomorrow, Jewish people come to faith in Jesus just like anybody else does, just like all you did. They had to be asking questions. They had to be seeking the truth. The Holy Spirit had to draw them. And they had to be open, and he had to open their hearts, and they had to respond. My pastor, someone came to his doorstep at New York State University, knocked on his door and said, have you ever read Isaiah 53? My pastor said no at the time. He wasn't a believer. Read him Isaiah 53. My pastor said, oh, that must be about Jesus, but I don't believe it. So he slammed the door. Well, that night he went home and read it himself on his own, took his own time, and opened up his Bible and read it. And that's how he came to faith. Then he showed it to his mom. 2 weeks later, his mom said, I don't see anything about Jesus in that text. So the point is that my pastor was open. He was seeking, and obviously God opened his heart, and he responded. You know, everybody's got to be drawn to God, and everybody's got to be seeking, asking answers. You know, just like anybody else, whether you're Jew or Gentile, you have to be drawn by God and be open, to the Spirit. So I think having said that, since we've got a block tomorrow, I'm going to now go into discussion time. So let's shoot some questions and talk, okay? Yeah.
I want to see if you can clarify some sure. of terminology.
Yeah.
A lot of us,
yeah.
Words that get used interchangeably a lot, maybe somewhat fairly, somewhat unfairly. You know, Israelite, Israeli,
yeah.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
What are the distinctions?
I think if you're living in Israel, I think if you're actually living in Israel as a Jewish person, you can go by the term, you know, name Israelite more there. It's very common, like if you're living in the land. I think if you're in the United States, you generally don't manage to walk around and say, I'm an Israelite. You just may say, I'm a Jewish person. I don't know, none of my Jewish friends describe themselves as Israelites. If you go to Israel, you probably hear that a little more, like on the streets or whatever, because they're actually living in the land, from what I've seen. That Jewish people, Israelite, what was the other word?
Hebrew.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know too many Jewish people call themselves, they walk around saying I'm a Hebrew. Mostly just they just call themselves Jewish people in the United States. I don't know anybody. I mean, the only time I hear the word Hebrew, the Hebrews, is when I hear a pastor preaching from the Bible sometimes. They'll say that. Like, and the Hebrew people are, I don't hear it much anywhere in the culture generally.
Don't
describe themselves as Hebrews.
Don't call them a Jew either. I got an earful from my father. So if you're ever referring to someone who is Jewish in America, that person is Jewish.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't. Yeah, you want to refer to them as Jewish people. You don't say the Jews necessarily, or he's a Jew. You say Jewish people. That's a lot more helpful in general. Now, let me say something else. Of course, naturally, of course, I remember something now. Christianity, you know, to Jewish people, the average Jewish person, there's nothing Jewish about Christianity. Nothing. Today's Christianity, the way it's presented in our culture. Yes, all the early believers were Jews. Okay. Yes, it started as a sect of Judaism. There was no Christianity when Jesus came. Okay, he didn't. I gotta say this. So I'll just say this from be blunt. I don't think Jesus came and started Christianity. Okay, he came. I mean, he came in as part of the Jewish world. It morphed into Christianity later, which became more Gentiles. I'll talk about my Jewish roots class, which you now have to come. But the point is that, you know, to think like Jesus comes, he brings Christianity, no more Judaism, is just historically inaccurate. Okay, it's just not accurate. If you read the current scholarship, it's just not accurate. So the point is that Jewish people do not see anything Jewish about Christianity. They think it's like a non-Jewish religion. And so you've got to break down those barriers to even show them it even has a Jewish context to it. You know? And that's a real challenge. And that's why Messianic Judaism exists. Because these are Jewish people just like the believers in the first century who are practicing the Jewish life, who are trying to live an authentic Jewish witness, and not just because they want to be really cool, just because they really believe Jewish identity is important. They want to maintain a Jewish lifestyle and worship the Lord, follow Jesus as well. So that's why I think Messianic Judaism has a role to play in God's, whatever he's doing with Jewish people, I think it does. It's not the easiest thing to understand, but you can talk about that more tomorrow. Yeah.
What Paul says,
yeah.
Could you argue that Paul then started Christianity as we know it? If Jesus didn't.
I don't think either Jesus nor Paul started Christianity. When I say Christianity, you're talking about Christianity as an empirical, as a, what's the word I use? Not empirical. Christianity as a institutional-based religion, maybe. I guess that's the word I use. That's more like 4th century later on, where it becomes more of like an institution. Like with Constantine much later on. If you were viewed as a Christian in the first century, meaning you're a follower of Jesus and you're a Jew following him, you were part of Judaism. You were one of the many sects of Second Temple Judaism in that circle. You weren't apart from the Jewish world. Today, Christianity's apart from the Jewish world. There's nothing Jewish about Christianity today because later on in history, like time goes on, there's no exact date we have it. There's kind of some markers there. The Christian began to just split and became more of a Gentile-based religion. But that is a gradual process that took lots of time, like lots of time. It's not like pre-70 AD. Now Paul certainly, it's not like Jesus isn't bringing anything new. He brought the new covenant. There's new theology. I'm not saying nothing's new. I'm just saying in that time period, you would have been considered part of Second Temple Judaism, a sect of Judaism, the sect of the Nazarenes, the way, like Acts talks about.
But
yeah.
Oh,
I don't care. I mean, I think Christianity is what it is. I'm just saying, reaching Jewish people, that's one of the barriers they have, because they don't see anything Jewish about it. Now, Christianity is what it is. There's many denominations, different ways of worship. I'm saying Messianic Judaism is probably the one thing out there that's trying to, you know, maintain like a Jewish identity or a Jewish, expression culturally. It's cross-cultural missions, you know, in that way. And I think that's an option. But for some Jewish people, it won't work for them. I had a Jewish girl that went to my congregation. She's like, I don't like it. I'm going to Vineyard. She goes to Vineyard. That's fine. I don't care. I'm just saying it's not going to be for every Jewish person. It just depends. I got so many hands. Which one? How about you? Yeah. Then I'll go back there.
I guess like my question about like how there's a lot of prophecy that like foretells like you know Jesus like Daniel 9.
That's fine. Yeah.
But she says that she doesn't believe in any of the books past the Torah.
Yeah.
Is that common? Like, so you're not able to use like Psalm 22 and Isaiah and all those. Is that a common thing? Or I'm wondering why she thinks that.
It is a common thing, and they don't place a lot of emphasis on the prophets. It's just the Torah is the most relevant thing, and so you're right. But you can still use the Torah to show her the Messiah in the Torah, like Genesis 49, 8 to 12, about the scepter there. You could talk about the prophet like Moses in Deuteronomy 18, 15 to 18. A prophet like Moses. It has to be a prophet like Moses. That's the text you could use. Numbers 24, 17. If she wants to stick with the Torah, I would just say, okay, let's look at some texts in the Torah that speak about maybe the coming of the Messiah. Those would be starters. On this bibliography, let's see. Yeah, Michael's book has a good thing in that, Volume 3. Michael Redelnik's book down here, The Messianic Hope's good to use on that. By the way, if anybody, on the way out, if you do want to reach me ever, I left a big stack here. This is my contact info. So if we don't cover everything... you have super secessionism. N.T. Wright writes a lot of books. He's very popular. I like him, but he thinks when Jesus came, you know, there's no future for necessarily for Israel either, even though Romans 9 through 11, it's tough to get through those texts there. Good Christians can disagree on these things. I have a lot of good friends of mine are Christians. We don't agree. You know, it's just we just agree to disagree. But the point is, though, that, as I'll be talking about this more tomorrow, is that if you don't believe Israel has a future, then you're going to have a heck of a time reading those second coming messianic texts like Isaiah 11, Isaiah 2, Jeremiah 23, Zechariah 14. It's going to be hard to make sense of those texts if you don't believe Israel has a future. Another thing, preterism is really big in Christianity now because the Left Behind series, everybody reacted to that and said those are just, we're going to, you know, that stuff, we can't have that. And so the preterist movement's been on the rise, which basically believes a lot of this stuff's been fulfilled in pre-70 AD, around the first century. That's a big movement now among young evangelicals as well. Then you've got a huge reform theology movement. I mean, the Calvinism movement is very big. And their, you know, their view of Israel may not, I mean, I don't agree with them. But, like I said, I agree to disagree. I love my brothers and sisters there. We just don't agree on it. Welcome to Christian theology. That's the way it is. Yeah. Okay, yeah. There's a woman that works here. I just met her today. She was a Jewish atheist. Now she was Sarah, or she down the bottom. She's on staff here. Anyway, she was an example of someone who's a Jewish atheist. My experience with Jewish atheists, I can't say I've seen any Jewish atheists come full turnaround to God then Messiah. I've seen some of them maybe become, you know, my goal is always is to get them just to theism, just to get them believing God. You know, what can I say? It's the same thing probably you deal with. I've tried to just minister to them and try to answer their objections. But like the girl I told you at Ohio State, that she came to Frank Turek, and she was a Jewish atheist. She said, I saw her a month later at the campus, and she was like, I still don't believe in God. And I said, well, did you... I gave you a free copy, Vine of Faith to be an Atheist. Did you read it? Did you go through it? And she's like, yeah. She's like, I just don't think you can really know anything. She said, I don't think you can trust eyewitness testimony. I don't think you can trust memory. I don't think you can really know truth. I don't think you can trust logic. I was like, well, what do you believe? Anyway, how do you live your life? So she was just a hyper-postmodern skeptic. I think you also see a lot of postmodernism in Judaism, too. Truth is not that important to a lot of Jewish people, at least my experience. You know what it is? Pragmatism. Pragmatism means if something works, you do it. And so if this Yeshua Jesus thing works for you, try him out. Not my cup of tea, but if it works for you, try it. Pragmatism is dominating. I think it's the same thing like anybody else. You just have to keep praying and pray God opens their heart. That's all you can do. You know, prayer is half the battle. You have to just keep praying. But you're further along with a lot of other Jewish people I've seen. That's good. So, okay. All right. Then I'll go there. Yeah, you both had your hand up or one?
having sort of like almost counseling sessions for
right.
people with any problems. Well, another woman who was in there doing it, that at the same time, she was Jewish.
Right.
And so, and basically we were on the same line. You know, we were wanting the same things for these people to heal their broken lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She says, I don't have any hope to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to help these people, but I don't really have anything to offer.
Mm-hmm.
And what I realized today, listening to you guys in your questions about your friends, is what got to her was we were ministering together, even though we were of different faiths and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So her seeing me minister to people with God's love and being able to offer them God's hope is what broke into her heart.
I think that's right. I will say, though, I think that after talking a lot of Jewish people, I do think the truth question is really, I've never seen, I mean, the postmodern mindset on them has just gone up and up over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, it's like, I always say, what if it turns out, what if it's true? Like, what if Jesus really is a Messiah and it's true? And they're like, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess you just live your life a certain way. And, you know, you're trying to always bring them back around to truth. It's just, it's like a wall there, just trying to get through that truth issue. So I think the actions are good. I think that's good. But as long as we've taken and pointed back to the person of truth, like, you know, pointing back to the person of hope, always points back to Christ. You know what I mean? Because, like I said the other day, I mean, you know, we've got religions that are doing, Jewish people do a lot of good things. They do a lot of amazing things, you know, but they're still missing their Messiah. And that's really sad. That's really hard.
It came down to what you were saying of the pragmatism.
Right.
What
it's everywhere.
What
yep. It's everywhere, right. They'll look at you and say, is your life working? Well, maybe Jesus isn't the Messiah, so you got a problem, you know. So, anyway. Anybody else? We got time? Yeah.
Earlier you said that
yeah. Well, when I mean salvation, I mean that they're not thinking in terms of the way we view salvation, like getting saved. To the extent of having our sins forgiven, knowing that we're saved from the wrath of God, you know, that kind of mindset's generally not there. So when they go through the high holiday season, it's a very holy time. It's important to them. But for some Jewish people, they already have a covenant with God. Israel has that covenant. You see, they don't need to like keep getting it back or. You know, they're already in covenant. So they're just not thinking in terms of heaven, hell, getting saved, because they don't believe that they're going to be judged like the way we do. You know what I mean? Because the Messiah question's there. They don't believe he's the Messiah. So I'd say at the end of the 10-day period, they think it's important, but they're not thinking in terms of, do I know for sure I have salvation? It's an issue of atonement. You know, they think that they've gotten right with God. They pray to God, confess their sins. That's it for the year. Then they do it the following year, and that's it. So a lot of it has to do with the review of the afterlife, has to do with the review of God, and has to do with the review of atonement. Because they don't believe, obviously, the atonement issue. Like, we believe, you know, we believe the blood atonement, really. I mean, Jesus, you know, is the atonement. And they are not viewing atonement that way, because there's no temple now. They pray to God directly. Because when Israel didn't have a temple, you know, so they always did in the Old Testament. Daniel prayed. God heard his prayer. That's what Jews say to me. Like, Daniel prayed, God heard his prayer. I don't need a temple. I don't need a, you know, I can pray to God directly. They've got a point, but God also used, sometimes he used a righteous individual to be their mediator, like Moses interceded and stood in the gap when God was going to judge Israel, and other times. So you have to look at the context of when that happens.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.